You know how you sometimes look at the world and just wonder, why are some countries doing so well economically while others seem to be really struggling?
Yeah, it's a huge question, right? One a lot of people think about.
Absolutely. So, welcome everyone to this deep dive. We're hoping this is your shortcut to getting a real handle on the whole world of economic development.
Exactly. We're digging into what makes countries tick, economically speaking. We've gone through a pretty detailed chapter that really breaks down what economic development means, how we measure it,
Why there are these big differences we see everywhere.
and importantly, what can maybe be done about it. Yeah.
So, our mission here is to pull out the really key insights for you. What does development actually involve? Because, well, it's definitely more than just money, as we'll find out.
Right.
We'll look at tracking it, the reasons for the gaps, and potential paths forward. Think of it like getting the core knowledge without wading through textbooks for months.
And we'll touch on some interesting frameworks too, like Rostow's stages of growth, sort of a historical model,
Oh, yeah.
and also how different big organizations like the UN and the World Bank actually classify countries today. There are some, well, perhaps surprising distinctions there.
Okay, sounds good. Let's dive in. So, first things first, economic development. Is that just, the economy getting bigger, more GDP?
That's a really common starting point, but it's crucial to see it's broader than that. Economic growth, the increase in output or income, yeah, that's part of it. But economic development, while that's a much bigger idea, it's really about sustained effort by governments, by societies, to lift the overall well-being and living standards of everyone.
Okay, so it's not just the size of the economic pie, but maybe how it's sliced and other things
It
too.
exactly. It includes improvements in like education, access to healthcare, better roads, power, internet, infrastructure, and also things like greater equality, more opportunities for people. And increasingly, you have to factor in environmental sustainability. Is the progress lasting?
So it's the numbers, the quantitative stuff, but also the quality of life, the qualitative side.
Precisely. Both matter for real development. It's about improving lives now and for the future.
That makes a lot more sense. Okay, so progress across the board. Now, you mentioned Rostow's stages. The chapter talked about that. What's the basic idea there?
Yeah, Walt Rostow, he was an economist who came up with this influential model, kind of a theory on how economies tend to evolve. He suggested this five-stage framework. The idea is that societies generally move through these phases as they shift from, say, mostly farming economies towards more industrial and then service-based ones. It's a way to visualize the path, you know?
Kind of roadmap. Okay, five stages. Let's walk through them. Where does it start?
Stage one is the traditional society. Think economies heavily based on agriculture, often subsistence farming, just growing enough to survive. Technology is pretty basic. There's not much innovation. Productivity is low because it's mostly manual work. Trade is limited, maybe just local stuff. Very little industry. Things change slowly.
Got it. Mostly farming, not much going on economically beyond that. What's next? How do things start changing?
Stage two is the preconditions for takeoff. This is where you start seeing the groundwork being laid for bigger changes.
Like what?
Well, investments start happening in key infrastructure. Think transportation roads, railways, ports, maybe energy, communications.
Oh, okay, the basics.
Exactly. And farming starts getting better, more productive. Maybe there's a surplus to trade now. Banks start popping up. You see the very beginnings of industry and more connections to markets, maybe even international ones.
So building the foundation makes sense. Then what? What's the takeoff part?
That's stage three, takeoff. This is where things really accelerate. You get a big surge in industrialization, often in manufacturing.
Okay, factories start appearing.
Right. And investment rates shoot up. Rostow talked about maybe 10% or more of national income being invested.
Wow.
And the institutions needed to support this, growth banks, transport systems, maybe a reliable legal system that becomes stronger, more established. People start moving to cities for factory jobs, so urbanization increases. The key thing is growth starts feeding itself. It becomes self-sustaining.
Things are really moving now. So, after takeoff, what does the economy look like?
Stage four is the drive to maturity. The economy starts to branch out. It's not just about those first few industries anymore.
Diversification.
Exactly. Technology spreads more widely across different sectors. Living standards generally rise. The economy isn't quite so reliant on, say, just textiles or steel anymore. And you also see more investment in people. better education systems, healthcare, maybe some social safety nets starting to form. It's about broadening and deepening the whole economic structure.
A more complex, resilient economy, and the final stage in this model.
Stage 5. The age of high mass consumption. Here, the focus shifts significantly towards the consumer. Lots of goods and services are available.
Right, shopping malls and...
Pretty much. A large part of the population has high incomes, relatively speaking. The service sector, finance, retail, entertainment, healthcare, becomes dominant. There's a strong consumer culture, well-developed social welfare programs, lots of access to higher education.
Interesting. It's a neat way to think about the journey, even if reality is messier, I guess.
Oh, for sure. It's a model, a simplification.
Yeah.
But it provides a useful framework.
Okay. Now, shifting slightly, the chapter also talked about how different organizations actually classify countries now. How do they do that?
Yeah, there are a few main ways you hear about.
Mm-hmm.
One key one is from the United Nations, the Human Development Index. HDI.
HDI, right. I've heard of that.
It's quite broad.
Yeah.
It looks beyond just the economy to overall human well-being. It measures three main things.
Sure.
A long and healthy life, basically. Life expectancy. Second, education, looking at both how many years kids are expected to be in school and how many years adults actually were.
Okay. Health and education.
And third, a decent standard of living, which they measure using gross national income, or GNI, per capita.
GNI, not GDP.
Slightly different. GNI includes income residents get from abroad and subtracts income sent out. It can be a bit closer to the actual income available to people in the country.
Got it. So HDI uses those three, and then...
Based on the country score across those dimensions, the UN puts them into four categories. Very high, high, medium, and low human development.
So that gives a richer picture than just income. What's the other main classification?
That comes from the World Bank. They focus much more directly on income levels.
Okay.
They classify countries using that GNI per capita figure we just mentioned. Their main groups are high income, upper middle income, lower middle income, and low income. It's a more straightforward economic ranking based on average income.
Right. So UN is broader human development. World Bank is more income groups. Makes sense. And then we just hear developed and developing economies thrown around all the time. How do those terms fit in?
Yeah, those are more general labels, less formal definitions perhaps, but widely used. They're basically shorthand to distinguish countries that have reached a high level of economic development from those still, well, developing.
And what are the typical differences?
Well, you usually see some common patterns. Developed economies tend to have advanced infrastructure, high tech. Developing economies often have infrastructure that's... less developed or maybe outdated.
Oh.
GDP per capita is generally high in developed, lower in developing. The main source of jobs is often the service sector in developed countries, whereas in developing countries, a bigger chunk of the workforce might be in farming or resource extraction, the primary sector.
Right, like in Rostow's earlier stages.
Exactly. And usually, developed economies score high on that HDI index we talked about, have higher living standards overall. Developing economies often face challenges there.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and one more thing. Developed economies are usually more diversified. They don't rely on just one or two things. Developing economies might be heavily dependent on exporting, say, just coffee or copper.
That really clarifies the typical distinctions. Okay, so we know how countries are classified. But how do economists actually measure all this development progress? What tools do they use?
It's really a mix of indicators, both those quantitative number-based ones and more qualitative ones.
Like what specifically?
Well, we've mentioned GDP per capita and GNI per capita. Those are key for average output or income. But then you also need to look at income inequality. How is that wealth spread out? Things like the Gini coefficient measure that.
Okay, so not just the average, but the distribution.
Crucial. Then there are health indicators, life expectancy, infant mortality rates. Education metrics like literacy rates, average years people spend in school.
Right, the HDI components again.
Exactly. They also look at the structure of the economy, what percentage of people work in agriculture versus industry versus services, and basic infrastructure access, like what percentage of people have electricity or clean water or sanitation.
So it's like a dashboard of different metrics.
That's a great way to put it. You need that dashboard to really compare countries fairly and track how they're changing over time across all these important dimensions.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, the big question, maybe, why?
Right.
Why are there such massive differences in economic development across the globe? What drives these gaps?
Yeah. This is where it gets really complex and lots of factors intertwine, but we can break down some key areas the chapter highlighted.
Let's do it.
Okay, first, just the basic level of income per capita itself. Higher income tends to mean more spending, more saving, more investment. Mm. It can create a positive feedback loop for growth.
Right.
Whereas low-income countries can get stuck in what they call poverty traps.
Okay.
Not enough income to save or invest much, which keeps income low.
Vicious cycle.
Exactly. And related to that are saving rates. Developed countries generally have higher rates of saving. That money provides the capital needed for businesses to invest, for infrastructure projects, R&D, and so on.
Uh-huh.
In many developing countries, savings rates are lower, which limits the funds available for that kind of investment and expansion.
Okay, income and savings. What else?
Investment levels themselves, both from within the country and from overseas. Developed nations often attract more foreign investment. Why? Maybe more political stability, stronger legal systems, bigger markets. Perceived as less risky.
Right.
Developing countries might struggle with things like capital flight money leaving the country, or just lower investor confidence. Getting enough investment can be a real challenge.
So income, savings, investment, they're all tightly linked. Any other major factors?
Definitely. Population growth rates can play a big role. Especially in poorer countries, really rapid population growth can put a huge strain on resources.
How so?
Well, think about needing more schools, more hospitals, more houses, more jobs, all just to keep pace. It can dilute the impact of any economic growth on a per-person basis. Developed countries often have slower, more stable population growth, which can make resource management a bit easier.
Interesting point. What about people themselves, education and health?
Absolutely critical.
Yep.
The quality of a country's education and healthcare systems is paramount. Better education leads to a more skilled, more productive workforce. Better healthcare means people live longer, healthier, more productive lives.
Makes sense.
But unfortunately, many developing nations struggle here. Systems might be underfunded, infrastructure lacking, access unequal. This really holds back potential.
So investing in human capital is key. What about the actual structure of the economy we talked about earlier?
Yes, that sectoral distribution matters a lot. Developed countries usually have most people working in services, the tertiary sector. These jobs often generate higher incomes, more value added compared to agriculture or basic manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
In many developing countries, agriculture, the primary sector, is still the biggest employer, and those incomes tend to be lower and more volatile.
And what about trade? What countries sell to the world?
Big difference there, too. Economies that mainly export raw materials,
yeah,
unprocessed commodities like ore, timber, basic farm products, they're often vulnerable. Global prices for these things can swing wildly. Plus, just exporting raw stuff doesn't always generate as much revenue or drive as much technological progress as exporting higher value manufactured goods or sophisticated services. That difference in the nature of exports is significant.
Okay, one more.
Productivity. Just how much output do you get per worker? Or per hour worked. Developed countries generally have much higher productivity.
Why is that?
Usually down to better technology, more efficient management practices, maybe better infrastructure supporting businesses, and that higher skilled workforce we mentioned. Developing countries often lack access to the latest tech or the capital to invest in it.
Wow. Okay, so it really is a whole web of interconnected factors. Income, savings, investment, population, education, health, economic structure, trade, productivity.
Exactly. No single silver bullet. It's the interplay of all these things.
So given these huge differences driven by all those factors,
yeah,
what are the actual tangible impacts we see in the world because of these development gaps?
Oh, the impacts are profound and wide-ranging. The most obvious is just massive inequality in living standards.
Mm-hmm.
Huge differences in basic things. Access to food, clean water, housing, healthcare, opportunity. Quality of life varies dramatically.
Yeah.
These disparities often fuel migration pressures, right? Mm-hmm. People moving, seeking better economic futures elsewhere.
Sure.
You also see global trade imbalances. Sometimes it's developed countries exporting high-value goods, developing countries exporting lower-value raw materials.
We talked about that.
Then there are the clear health and education gaps. These don't just reflect inequality, they perpetuate it, limiting people's potential in poorer nations.
Right, locking in disadvantage.
There's the technological divide, too, which can make it harder for less developed countries to compete globally, especially in newer knowledge-based industries.
Mm-hmm.
Some countries become heavily reliant on foreign aid, which can be necessary, but also potentially create issues of dependency or influence policy. And sadly, environmental problems can sometimes hit harder in developing countries. maybe due to lack of resources for sustainable practices, weaker regulations, or sometimes development choices that prioritize immediate growth over environmental protection.
It really paints a stark picture of how interconnected global problems are with these development levels. So what can actually be done? What strategies can help less developed countries move forward?
The chapter outlined a couple of main pathways. One is foreign aid.
Okay, aid. What does that involve exactly?
It's basically the voluntary transfer of resources from more developed countries or international bodies to developing ones. This could be money grants or loans, but also goods like food or medicine, or technical expertise like training or advice.
And who provides this aid?
Governments, through their own aid agencies, and major multilateral organizations like the IMF, the World Bank, regional ones like the Asian Development Bank or African Development Bank.
Got it. And what forms does it take?
All sorts. Financial aid, as I said, technical assistance, sending experts, food aid, especially in emergencies, help building infrastructure, roads, power plants, schools.
And what's the main goal?
Generally, the aims are things like improving health and education services, building that crucial infrastructure, strengthening government institutions and promoting good governance, and trying to stimulate the local private sector, encourage businesses.
Okay, so aid is one major tool. What's the other key strategy mentioned?
The other big one is tapping into the interdependence of the global economy.
Interdependence, meaning?
Meaning that in today's world, economies are incredibly linked through trade and investment. Very few countries operate in isolation. Growth often depends on connecting with the global system.
How does that happen?
Through things like trade agreements. Countries lowering barriers to trade between them, through global supply chains where different parts of making a product happen in different countries, and through international organizations that try to manage this system, like the World Trade Organization, or groups like the G20 where major economies coordinate.
And what are the benefits of this interdependence, ideally?
Well, the idea is it can promote peace if countries rely on each other economically, they're maybe less likely to fight. It can increase efficiency. Countries specialize in what they do best and trade, and it gives businesses access to much bigger markets beyond their own borders.
So it's kind of a two-pronged approach then. Direct support through aid, plus fostering integration into the global economic system.
That seems to be the main idea presented, yes. Helping countries build capacity internally while also helping them connect and compete externally.
It really underscores how complex this all is. Understanding these dynamics, the stages, the measures, the causes of the gaps, the potential solutions like aid and trade, it's pretty essential if you want to make sense of the world today.
Absolutely. It gives you a framework, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
For looking at global challenges, for evaluating different policies and efforts aimed at creating a world that's, well, more equitable and maybe more prosperous for everyone.
It definitely gives you a deeper perspective on the forces shaping our planet. Okay, so considering everything we've just unpacked, Rostow's ideas, the different ways we classify countries, all those root causes of the disparities, and these potential paths forward with aid and global connections, what do you think, just as a final thought, what's maybe the single most critical element a developing country needs to really achieve that lasting economic development?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? So many factors are crucial.
It really makes you think. And on that note, we really hope this deep dive has sparked some thoughts for you, our listeners. We encourage you to maybe dig deeper into whatever aspect resonated most. There's always more to learn about this vital topic.